I'm Jane Lindholm. This is Vermont Edition, and if you listen closely, you may be able to hear the sound of the wind, maybe a few birds, a voice chanting, and a little bit of traffic. They are the sounds of Afghanistan. Specifically, they are sounds collected around Bagram Air Base in the past 3 years by anthropologist Noah Coburn and artist Greg Thielker. The two professors collaborated on an exhibit that is now up at Bennington College. Called Ungoverned Spaces, the exhibit aims to document life in Afghanistan that carries on amidst conflict, and it uses words and images, as well as these sounds piped in as ambient noise, to convey a sense of place and time. Today we're going to talk with the creators of this exhibit and get their perspective on life in Afghanistan and what they're hoping visitors to their exhibit will experience. Noah Coburn, Greg Thielker, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Jane.
Take me into the exhibit. We were just hearing some of the sounds that you pipe in through speakers. They're very subtle, especially probably if you're listening on the radio, perhaps driving in your car. But if you're there, they put you in a soundscape that kind of traces an outline of a place. So now the visual. Noah Coburn, what would we see?
Well, the real centerpiece of the exhibition is a 35-foot panorama that was painted by Greg. And it's of a scene just a little ways north of the airbase. And it's really meant to try to bring the viewer into the space around the airbase. And what you'll see is you'll see a village off to the distance. You'll see a river running by with fields, mountains sort of dominating the landscape. And in the distance to the right, you'll see some walls from the base with barbed wire cascading down the hillside, but it's subtle. And for us, it's meant to bring the viewer into the way that the war has sort of subtly shaped the landscape in Afghanistan.
Greg Thielker, tell me more about making this panoramic painting that you made.
Sure. This has been a project or an idea, actually, that I developed with Noah early on. And then it just took a long time to both sort of execute and also figure out what was sort of important in making it. When I was young, I had visited the Gettysburg Cyclorama with my family, going there to experience not only the battlefield, but this enormous painting in a cyclorama format, which used to be a popular form of pre-cinema entertainment. And of course, that cyclorama displays a three-day battle. It's quite riotous with horses charging and gunfire. But it made sort of a very strong impression on me about the potential for painting to be an immersive sort of experience. And I had thought about a way to create an image in Afghanistan that would do something similar but be markedly differently in its tone. And this panorama does that. It's unromantic. There aren't very noticeable senses of warfare. As Noah described, there are certain things you can see very subtly, an observation blimp off in the distance, the rings of the Hindu Kush Mountains. But it nevertheless uses this historic format to tell a little bit of a different story about Afghanistan.
And when you sort of tie it in with the Gettysburg cyclorama that you're talking about, expand on that idea of what a landscape at war or in conflict looks like. Because, Greg, you're saying, you know, this has a very different look. What's the feel like when you're there?
I think for me, it was as an artist, I was using the tools that I have to sort of record those experiences, and those aren't just drawing or painting, as you were describing earlier. It's sound recordings and photography. It was a way in a sense for me to sort of be objective. When I was there with Noah, we were driving around in an old Toyota Corolla, and in each place that we stopped, Noah would be conducting interviews on the ground. I would have time to just kind of walk around the area to explore, to make notes, and to do these sound recordings. So the experiences of that valley and over the course of the several years we've been working on this project were recorded in bits and pieces. In the panorama, however, they're sort of stitched together. No view is completely objective or accurate, and yet they're sort of woven together to create, I think, a more a more diverse perspective rather than a single image or a painting taken from one specific moment in time.
Noah Coburn, your ethnographic research is reflected in words that are blended into this exhibit. Can you give me an example of what people might see?
Well, in the exhibition, you'll see a lot of different things, and a lot of that has come from the time I spent previously in Afghanistan. I did my initial dissertation field work there, living in a small town up in the mountains, and I wrote what in many ways is sort of a standard ethnographic account of that town. But when I came down and started doing more research, and this is around 2010, 2011, around Bagram Air Base, one of the things that was immediately noticeable was the way that the air base greatly complicated the political landscape. And as I started writing in my notes and in other places, I became frustrated by simply presenting a single linear narrative because it felt to me like what was happening there was actually much more complex than that. So the images of text and the text that you can read are changing. They're up on video monitors, so they're not fixed. And they present the area from a series of different voices. So some of them are simply excerpts from interviews. Others of them are more ethnographic writing, and some of them are drafted in the form of policy pieces. There are some which are historical accounts of the place, and it's really meant to get the viewer thinking about the fact that each of these narratives is incomplete, and in many ways, actually, some of these narratives contradict each other and work against each other, but really, to get that sense of the place, you need to sit there and think about these contradictions and be immersed in these tensions and different ways of thinking.
We're learning today about an art and anthropology exhibit up at Bennington College right now. It's called Ungoverned Spaces, and it's a collaboration between Bennington College anthropology professor Noah Coburn and assistant professor of art at the College of New Jersey, Greg Thielker. They are sharing their impressions of Afghanistan and what they hope visitors to their exhibit will get out of it. And listeners, if you have a question about life in Afghanistan from their perspective, call 1-800-639-2211. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts or your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Greg and Noah, both of you have now talked about this idea of subjectivity versus objectivity and whether what people experience when they come into this exhibition is something that is sort of factual or is a moment in time or is even a moment in time as remembered by the artist or by a conversation. Why is that something that you want to play around with? Greg, let me go to you first.
Sure. And I think I can relate that to just the experience of being there with Noah. We would often go out with research assistants out into the field and then returning to Kabul in the evening after a full day of kind of working and exploring and then talk about what happened and then have totally different reactions or things that stood out to us. And I think that sort of speaks to the idea that two people can be in the same place, experience it, and take very different things away. Of course, we're sort of channeling that through the different disciplines of art and anthropology, but I think it's an idea that's pretty central to the exhibit.
Noah, jump in there.
Well, I think the thing that I would add is one of the things that we're working on is expanding the lenses that we use to talk about Afghanistan. And one of those is historic. And particularly around Bagram, history has left these very fascinating uneven layers. So Bagram right now is a NATO airbase, but before that, the Soviets were there, and you can see Soviet-style architecture. Before that, the British had an important camp in the area in the 19th century. Emperor Babur passed through the area with his army. Alexander the Great camped in the area. And these levels of history have then shaped the communities in some really sort of fascinating ways. So one of the pieces in the exhibition that's one of my favorites is from Greg and I after spending some time in Bagram. There was an archaeological dig site where a lot of pieces from Alexander the Great's camp had been dug up. So we went to the National Museum in Kabul to see some of these pieces. And it turns out that most of the pieces are actually on this worldwide tour that was meant to only last for 18 months, but because of security concerns, the pieces have never returned to Kabul. And so instead of having the pieces in the museum, there's just photos of the pieces. And these photos are quite old now, and so they're aging. And one of the things that I think is really nice is Greg then made a painting of one of these photos and tore it just a little bit to sort of represent some of that displaced nature of these artifacts. And so we're playing with the way that history leaves its mark and sometimes disappears and sometimes reappears in very surprising and interesting ways.
Greg, how much control do you then have over what visitors to the exhibition experience and take away with them? I mean, you're explaining some of your motivations and the way that you worked and what you present, but it sounds like there's also this sense of letting visitors to the exhibition figure some of this out on their own. So does it worry you that perhaps they don't get all those nuances, or they look at something and think of it more as a factual representation than you intend it to be?
I think this is a challenge that the artists are always worrying about to some degree. For my part, I'm often concerned with just making the painting, and each of these paintings is a long process. Actually, it gives me a lot of time to think while I'm working. As I mentioned, they're the result of both on-site studies and photographs, but then a lot of time is spent in the studio just trying to create shape and color. And the works, if you can see, either in the exhibit or on the website, are pretty detailed, so that I'm hoping viewers will come away with the idea of connection to the place, to the objects, to the landscape, but also to bring their own impressions. And I think those are equally valid as well.
No, I mean, there's a long history in the study of anthropology about how much to include your own voice in your ethnographic research and how much to translate to a reader or to somebody else who's experiencing your work about what perspective you're coming at it from. Did you think about that in creating this work?
Absolutely. This really came from a lot of the discussions I was having with Greg on this very topic. And I think one of the things we're really aiming for in this is not to have the viewer come away with any set of impressions, but instead to have the viewer begin to engage in a discussion, either with themselves or with other people in the space. And the space is actually divided into two pieces, and I worked with a group of students here at Bennington to set up one half of the gallery as a discussion space, essentially. And in that half of the space, we have a table with archival materials. We have a timeline that's up on the wall. We have a map of the area, but that's then contrasted with a map of Bennington and the area around Bennington. And really what we're hoping is to then not have the viewer walk away with a single impression, but walk away involved in a conversation, in a conversation that I don't think either Greg or I are really trying to resolve, in part because I think that's reflective of our collaborative process. And one of the things that can be frustrating at times, but also very richly rewarding, is the way that Greg and I potentially disagree on certain topics. And really working through those, I think, helps us to try to create the space that will similarly not create agreement, but create a conversation, really.
We are talking today about the perspective on life in Afghanistan that's presented in an art and anthropology exhibit up at Bennington College. It's called Ungoverned Spaces, and it's a collaboration between Bennington College anthropology professor Noah Coburn and assistant professor of art at the College of New Jersey, Greg Thielker. We're talking with both of them today, and listeners, if you have a question about their work or about their process or their multi-year experiences in Afghanistan, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with anthropologist Noah Coburn and artist Greg Thielker. They're sharing their impressions of Afghanistan, a country the pair has spent a lot of time in. They've collaborated on an art exhibition at Bennington College called Ungoverned Spaces. It combines Noah's words and ethnographic work with Greg's sketches, photos, and paintings. They're explaining what the exhibit is like and what they hope visitors will experience when they see it. And if you have a question for them about their perspective, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You both have explained a little bit of your process, Greg, going in and maybe being able to take photographs or doing some quick sketches of where you and Noah were for a day. Noah, could you talk a little bit more about how you got to different places? Were you traveling by yourselves? Were you able to get access to villages? How did that work?
Yeah, I began doing my research in Afghanistan in 2005 when things were actually much safer. And so I had spent some time in a small mountain town about 30 miles to the west and did my original research there. And it was a time, and everything they say about Afghan hospitality is true, where the whole town sort of looked after me and kept me safe. And I was very grateful for that and sort of built off of those relationships. So eventually what Greg and I did was used a series of my contacts and also some support from the United States Institute of Peace to begin working mostly independently, but also with a couple of Afghan research assistants who I had worked with in the past. And really, we decided that the best way to do this was to maintain a low profile. A lot of internationals in Afghanistan now travel in large convoys that are armed. And this, I think, really makes them targets, whereas we drove around in a beat-up Toyota Corolla for the most part. And there were certainly some villages around the town that were not, that do not support the presence there, and we didn't spend as much time there. But for the most part, Afghans are very open and hospitable and very eager to talk with us, even if it was simply to complain about what was going on in the base.
Where did you sleep?
We mostly spent the night in guest houses. So it would vary from night to night. Bagram is within driving distance of Kabul, so quite often we would just go back to Kabul for the evening.
So what kind of a relationship did you have with coalition forces, if any?
Very minimal, actually. We bumped into them on a few occasions, and in my previous research, but also a couple times with Greg, one of the things that's quite interesting is that the coalition forces tend to use non-local translators. So all of the discussion between forces and communities are going through these intermediaries who are oftentimes actually hostile to the communities. So quite regularly, actually, in my original town, the community would be very happy to have me act as a translator between these forces. And we would chat with the forces when we bumped into them, but we really made no effort to seek them out, because what we were trying to do was to experience the intervention as it was being experienced in those towns and villages.
Greg, you had done a lot of work in other parts of the world, but was this collaboration with Noah your first experience in Afghanistan?
It was, yes. And I think I had certain maybe expectations or ideas about things. But again, I think the process of collaboration really made it a dynamic experience. It made it a very rich one. And as Noah said, you know, there were different ways of working. And I actually find it very compelling as an artist to think about making art in a different fashion that maybe embraces these notions of ethnography, of interview, of different perspectives, which oftentimes we can think of very clearly in, say, writing or even music. But actually getting outside of the normal sphere of art was very helpful in this process.
How did you and Noah get together in the first place?
Well, I can say we both attended Williams College. I wouldn't say that we were good friends in school, but we had a certain sympathy for each other's work, and over the years sort of stayed in touch, continuing to talk about our individual projects and research. And really, over the course of a few long evening conversations, came up with this idea of the panorama and other works, which might be a way to do something that I was having trouble doing with art alone, and I think Noah saw the opportunity for it to happen in a different way than his other research and writing.
Noah, tell us about one of the panels that comes up on the screen of your words when visitors come into the exhibit. I'm thinking specifically right now of what are you serving?
Well, I think one of the things we tried to do was to insert at certain moments certain humor and just to give the viewer a sense of the reality of the experience. And the reality of the experience is that it's sometimes a little intimidating when these large troop convoys go by, but also there are Afghans in the bazaar telling jokes. And so we've got one of the panels is a conversation that we recorded basically just while having lunch, where the owner of the shop essentially asks the person, customer, what they want for lunch. And the customer asks for one thing and they don't have it. And he says, well, what do you have? And he says, oh, anything. And he asks for another thing and they don't have it. And then another thing and they don't have it. And then it turns out that they only have one dish. But trying to insert some of those moments in between some more serious pieces, I think, is important for trying to understand the different ways of seeing life there. And another really interesting thing that Greg and I did that maybe he can talk about as well is there was one government building that we visited on multiple occasions. And for me, that government building was quite interesting. It was really more the ruins of a government building. But it had been a guest house for internationals during the 1960s and 70s. It had then been taken over by the Soviet government. The Mujahideen groups had retaken it. And then there was intense fighting between the Mujahideen groups that actually knocked off the top of it. The Taliban came, the coalition forces came, and then left it for another building. And it just was this area which is so rich with all these different ways of fitting into Afghan history that to go there and ask people about it, we just found these sort of fascinating stories that then Greg played with artistically, I think, in some really interesting ways.
Greg, pick that up.
Sure, yeah. The building that Noah is talking about sits atop one sort of edge of the valley. We had gone first in the wintertime, and actually the car we were traveling in couldn't even make it up the hill. We had to get out and sort of push in order to get to the top of the hill due to the snow. But it meant that once we got inside, we had more time. And actually, this issue of time it was really useful, and it really varied depending on where we were. If it was the case that we were doing interviews, that didn't always mean that we were settled someplace. Sometimes when we were off somewhere a little bit further out, we had more time to just be in a place. And this was former government building was like that. I was able to kind of stand there quietly, do a series of sketches that I ended up developing into a large oil and linen painting, just done in tones of gray. It was a very subtle painting of a view looking out through the kind of blasted apart wall. A big chunk of concrete is dangling by iron rebar. And after spending 4 months on this painting, we actually ended up going back to the same building, only in the summertime. And all the schisms and little differences that I was able to identify, you know, really were pretty unsettling in terms of maybe parts that I had seen differently or described differently or things that had changed because we were there months later. And I think this was a good sort of experience which speaks to the overall project and the exhibit that, the efforts to be objective, the efforts to create representations while understanding that those processes are still flawed are nevertheless worth it.
Did you change the painting after that?
Did I change the painting? No, but it made me want to do a different painting. And I think there's something to that, the idea of repeating and re-describing things, forming a nice parallel with experience.
You know, that painting that you're discussing, Hanging Wall, with your perspective is from inside the building looking out. And it's an interesting painting because when you what you're looking out at seems to be a sort of pastoral snow scene. There's a little shed. It looks like maybe it's actually a shipping container and a car. You know, it could be anywhere, but then you're inside of a clearly shelled out building.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, the idea for painting especially is really dealing with the history of imagery, perhaps going back to romantic traditions, but also I think with this project lending a specificity, and for me as someone who really works a lot in realism, that sort of language being a tool to attempt to be objective, while at the same time realizing that there are certain flaws, and even while I might maintain a certain amount of detail and accuracy, that there are still going to be pieces missing, and that's valuable for us.
Did this work that you were doing, I understand it took place over a couple of years, 3 years of traveling back and forth to the region. Did the political landscape and then by extension the physical landscape change in that time, Noah?
Absolutely. One of the things you really could see, particularly around the years of the surge, and this was more visible in Kabul, but was certainly visible in Bagram as well, was just this building up, especially of walls, and this increased fortification. And Kabul is now very much this sort of fortified city. But now, as the troops have been withdrawing, it's fortified, but oftentimes there's just sort of emptiness behind the walls. And it's not always clear what is behind some of these walls because of this. So one of the bases that Greg and I spent some time around, it was more of a small command outpost. And we spent time around it, and it became increasingly clear that there was either almost nobody inside or very few soldiers inside. And it had been built in 2009 because of this massive expansion and then really scaled back. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this affects the landscape going forward, this sort of this massive buildup that's gone on. And talking to soldiers, even some returned soldiers here in Vermont, one of the really interesting things that some of my students did is they found someone who had been in Bagram and taken a lot of photographs there and interviews. And the really interesting thing he was talking about was all the tents that they lived in Bagram. And Bagram right now has no tents in it. It's been completely built up. But listening to the soldiers talk about Bagram as a changing place, too, was very interesting.
So, Greg, any plans to go back?
Sure, yeah. I think the impulse is there, the curiosity is there. It really depends on the opportunities to go. But I think it's still a place where there's all this visual interest. I think that there's a challenge there artistically in terms of the representation. There's which is curious and compelling for me. There's a certain amount of weight involved in delving into that, which I really appreciate and, again, is sort of strengthened through this collaboration with Noah.
That's Greg Thielker. He's an assistant professor of art at the College of New Jersey. We're also talking with Noah Coburn, an anthropology professor at Bennington College. Noah and Greg, thank you for telling us about your exhibit.
Thank you.
Their shared exhibit is called Ungoverned Spaces, and it's up at Bennington College's Ustan Gallery until December 2nd. We have a link for more information at vpr.net. Coming up, what it's like to get in the water with a shiver of great white sharks. We'll talk with a local filmmaker about the ethics and the excitement of filming animals. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're a fan of Shark Week, you may be familiar with the work of Andy Mitchell. The Middlebury resident is a documentary filmmaker who's traveled the world with his cameras, filming animals and other subjects. He's getting ready to share some of his stories and some of the fascinating characteristics of sharks at a talk in Middlebury later this month. Mitchell has invited his friend and colleague, Andy Casagrande, to help him open a new series of interactive discussions he's calling MUD Talks. MUD stands for Middlebury Underground Discussions. And the first one is called simply Sharks. Andy Mitchell stopped by the studio the other day to tell us about some of his experiences with these beautiful and misunderstood creatures.
We were in South Africa for a month, and the weather was so bad that we literally got about 4 days on the water. We just sat around waiting and waiting and twiddling our thumbs and getting ready and getting in our heads. And finally, we decided the day's not great, but we're going to go out anyway. And so we went out there, and the way that we were diving, it hadn't really been done much. So the way that we were going to do it was we were going to take the cage, drop it to the bottom. It's a place called Shark Alley in between two islands, which has a huge population of seals. So of course the sharks come and they just feed on the seals there. So we drop the cage to the bottom of the water and then turn it over kind of like a soccer goal.
Mm-hmm.
So we used it as our backdrop and our escape if we did get in trouble. And it's never the shark you're looking at that you're afraid of. It's the one you're not looking at. No one had really filmed these sharks on the bottom before. So it was a completely new shot, completely new perspective. And the weather was crap and the visibility was horrible. You couldn't see more than 5 or 6 feet. So I slowly edged out of the cage, and right then a big surge kind of came and pulled me a good 15, 20 feet away from the cage right towards the shark. And it was a beautiful shot. But the one thing you're not supposed to do when filming sharks is to back up, because the flight response, when you back up, that means you're running away. That means they attack. So obviously the first thing that I do, because I was pulled 30 feet out of the cage, was to back up as fast as I can, which just honed the predator instinct. And he came at me and everything was fine. And we got some really nice shots. But that was one of my first adrenaline-filled experiences with sharks. And it's just been, since then, it's just gotten better and better.
When you do shoots like that, how much research or how much knowledge do you already have about the animals that you're filming so that you know what kind of behaviors they have? And how does that actually affect how you set up shots, how you do the work?
A huge amount of research needs to go into all of these shoots. We have so little extra time and extra money that we really have to hit this as a surgical strike. We have an entire team. Usually we have an entire team of researchers who are talking to everybody. And scientists are our best friends. These people that have devoted their entire lives to sharks and to shark conservation and shark biology, they've spent 30 years learning everything there is to know about these animals. And we come in and treat them with the utmost respect and use that information to really target what we're going for. And by doing that, we're really able to stack the cards in our favor and find the right places at the right time of day, at the right season, the right conditions. And that's your only chance of getting the footage that you need.
So might there be a different way of filming because of the behavior of a great white versus the behavior of a whale shark?
Oh, every shark is different. Great whites they're wonderful. They're friendly. Each individual personality of each individual shark even differs. And you can tell pretty quickly that one's a player and they're going to circle you and they're going to play and they're curious and they're not going to attack you. And then every once in a while you get the big guy who comes in and you can just tell he's coming in hot and you can just tell he's not going to put up with you. And that's when knowing when to get back in the cage or get out of the water really, really comes in handy. But from whale sharks to tiger sharks to bull sharks to great whites, they're all different. And you treat them all differently. And it's not necessarily the biggest that's the most dangerous. In fact, the bull sharks, I think, would probably be the most dangerous because they're the most aggressive. Tiger sharks are one of the biggest, but they're actually kind of gentle. They're really sweet and nice. And you don't want to fight them, but you don't want to get on their nerves. But they're not going to attack you. Whereas a bull shark, I'm not so sure.
There's been a lot of talk in recent years, and I don't know any specifically about sharks, but about cinematography and documentary filmmaking about animals and the role of the people who are involved and whether they are not just in the way, but actually creating setup shots, maybe getting prey in an area so that they can get the right shot. How do you think about that and the ethics of what you're doing? Because you are in their environment and you're interacting with them.
It depends on who you're working for. National Geographic has a team called Standards and Practices. It's the moral compass of the National Geographic Society. We feel very strongly that everything you do, everything you say has to be true. And while we need to get ratings, we need to pump up the adrenaline. Every single thing you do and every single thing you say has to be honest and it has to be true. Now, Discovery Shark Week, without getting too into the details, are less afraid to sensationalize. And this will be something that we're going to show some clips and we're going to have a very honest discussion about at this event. And we're going to show some things that, that I did that I'm not that proud of, to be perfectly honest, in getting really cool shots of sharks, but maybe not doing it in the most ethical way. And like we never put the animals in danger, but certain production companies are really looking. The problem is in today's market, with today's short-sighted television market and the reality show and the grab for ratings, the old school wildlife shows can't compete.
Wild so America type thing.
They do great. They get the people that watch them. The broadcasters really are trying to reach the people that don't watch them.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get the people that aren't there every Sunday night to watch them. So they're doing things like tests with great whites. Do they prefer a baked ham or do they prefer a tuna? Obviously, it's meat. They're going to eat them all. And they make a big sensationalized scientific study on what to great whites like better, turkey or tuna. And it's kind of ridiculous, but it gets ratings. People watch it. National Geographic has a policy where you work with the scientists and you use them as your barometer on the health of the shark and putting the shark in danger. So you work with the scientist, we piggyback on their studies, and there's a lot of great scientists doing really interesting work, attaching cameras to sharks so that we can see where they go. I mean, it's really where sharks go after they come by us is still largely a huge mystery, especially the big ones like tiger sharks and great whites. So bottom line is, if you work with the scientist and you use their research and you use their equipment and their permits, to be honest, a lot of the time, then we can really feel good that what we're doing is not hurting the sharks and actually will ultimately benefit by increasing our knowledge base on the animals. So nowadays, we've gotten past the paying our dues stage and we can actually choose the projects that we feel better about. And I've stopped taking gigs that I don't agree with because I just – it's just not the right way to make television, in my opinion.
So you don't ever now have to work – I mean, a recent scandal was the idea of using trained animals to get some shots if you can't get the wild animals to do what you want them to do.
Yeah. It's a very common thing. It's very common. And there have been times where we've done it and I actually feel okay about it because it's a rehabbed animal. And all we're doing is getting a close-up eye or a close-up fur. And never in the script will we ever say, this is the animal that is doing this. But we will say the animal's eyes are incredibly sensitive. And we'll use a close-up from a trained animal. So there are some tricks of the trades that we try not to really publicize too much.
Until you decide to expose it in a mud talk.
but it's a real conversation to be had. And it's something that goes on all over the world. And I think actually the tide is changing now in that the more legit and the more real processes are more respected and I think people are willing to give up a little of the sensationalism to have a more honest production.
So, Andy, what's behind this idea of mud talks? This shark, sharks exclamation mark is the first talk that you're doing with your colleague, the other Andy. But you've got a raft of them set up and you and your wife, Lisa, are designing them. What do you want to get out of them? Why this need for a community dialogue?
This is an idea that my wife, Lisa, and I have been thinking about for a while. We sort of right now in Middlebury, it feels like there's a bit of a kind of a creative revolution going on. And there's a whole assortment of really amazing creative people doing really amazing things right here in Vermont. And we've long thought about starting a series of interesting talks and a community level that are much more intimate than your typical lecture. And I think kind of what we're getting at is a little bit different and hopefully it'll be rewarding for everybody.
So what else do you have in the hopper after sharks?
After sharks, we chose sharks as the first one, A, because it's what I do, and B, because it's toothy, and we thought it'd be a good first one to kind of – it's easy to promote. It's good. I think we can you know, it's good to sell.
Get people in the door.
We can get people in the door. The next one, we're very excited. We just recently booked the Refugee All-Stars of Sierra Leone for February 21st. It's a Saturday night. The Refugee All-Stars are a band of Sierra Leoneans who we met about 10 years ago in a refugee camp in Guinea. Four Middlebury alums, we went over there and we found this group. And we made a documentary film called Refugee All-Stars of Sierra Leone that released in 2005. And it led to their music career. And they've since had a number of albums, and they've played with Aerosmith and Bonnie Raitt and Bonnaroo and Central Park. And they've had a remarkable career. And since Ebola has ravaged West Africa, they have found themselves refugees again, stuck in Providence, Rhode Island, while their family and friends are all stuck back home and they can't get home. And as close friends, we're inviting them as the second Mud Talk to not only play music, but also begin a discussion about Ebola and hopefully raise a little bit of money for them to send home to their families, and another nonprofit called We Own TV that is based in Freetown that is actively trying to spread the word and really enlighten people on the realities of what's going on over there.
And then you've got other ones that you're hoping to do. So you're thinking that this will be an ongoing series. You want to keep this going.
We do. We have a contract with Town Hall Theater right now through the end of this year, through the end of this school year. Our plan is to do seasonal events, and we want every single one to be completely different. We want to cover a variety of topics. So our priorities are A, have a good time, B, walk away knowing something a little bit more, and then really bringing the community together.
Well, Andy, I hope it goes well, and thanks very much for telling us about sharks and about this concept of Mud Talks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andy Mitchell's opening Mud Talk, Sharks, is next Sunday, November 30th at Middlebury's Town Hall Theater. We have a link to more information at vpr.net. And finally today, time for your messages. Producer Patty Daniels joins me now to read some of your comments from recent programs. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. On Tuesday, we tackled the question of what it's like to live in Vermont for people who are lesbian, gay, transgendered, or who identify as queer. And during that show, Carl from Fairfield wrote in to say, "Your current subject matter on Vermont Edition is the primary reason I no longer contribute financially to VPR. VPR's queer-centric program matter reached a saturation point for me some time ago, and it continues to march along at the same beat."
But the program resonated with a lot of listeners. Molly wrote, "Growing up in the Upper Valley, there was little to no support for LGBTQ culture. So little that I never questioned my own sexuality because the idea that I could be gay wasn't really a possibility in my mind. It's surprising in an area that's very liberal and claims to be very supportive that resources are so lacking."
And PJ wrote, "I moved here 4 years ago from South Florida, where there's an abundance of gay clubs, bars, guest houses, and meeting places, but far fewer legal protections. I must say, I would never give up my ability to get married, file taxes, and enjoy protections of full citizenship for more gay culture. However, I do find myself missing and craving connection with my LGBT family, and I wish there was a way to have both."
And Ace tells us, "I moved to Vermont from the California Bay Area in 2002. As a white, middle-class, out, trans-identified butch person, living in Vermont has actually been more connective to community than when I lived in the Bay. Out there, you're just a drop in the ocean of queerness. Here, there is the possibility to know and be known by coworkers, neighbors, friends that transcends any one identity, but still allows for strong visibility for me as a trans and queer person."
Well, changing topics, last week we also talked with a few local scientists about the work they do on issues surrounding global climate change. And we were interested in how they engage in the public and political debate, which is often somewhat divorced from data.
Mark wrote in to say, "As a scientist myself, I would find it impossible to ignore the growing weight of the data suggesting that climate change is real and is a real threat. Unfortunately, climate deniers and politicians serving their own interests always demand the 100% absolute answer. Statistical significance simply isn't enough to quash their denials."
And Lori chimed in as well, writing, "Scientists have a key role in educating the public and policymakers about what climate change is, how it will affect them in their own communities, what behaviors they can modify, and what a realistic result of these changed behaviors will look like."
Finally, there have been some changes to what's called the broadcast clock on Morning Edition. Some segments, like Weather and the Writer's Almanac, have moved, and there are now more chances to hear local and national news headlines. You've probably been hearing from us about these changes, and we have certainly been hearing from you.
Many of you have told us that you are worried or frustrated by the adjustments, and some of you have even given us a minute-by-minute critique of the new clock. And there has been some hand-wringing on our part, too, but on Monday, the first day of the change, we got this note from Beth in Burlington. She writes, "For just another perspective, I'm a completely addicted, everyday listener, and I don't notice the difference with the new clock. Relax."
Thank you, Beth. Well, you can critique us or give us an alternative perspective anytime. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net or connect with us on social media. We are on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition. Thanks a lot, Patty.
You're welcome, Jane.
All right, that will do it for today's show. Listen tomorrow when Senator Patrick Leahy will be our guest for the full hour. We'll talk about President Obama's immigration plan, the Keystone XL pipeline, and a bill that Leahy sponsored but couldn't get passed that would have restricted government surveillance. The phone lines will be open for you to ask questions of Senator Leahy directly, or you can email now to vermontedition at vpr.net, and then be sure to tune in tomorrow live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Isla Yersel. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.